Hi, Marco Werman here. We're entering the season of gratitude and reflection. One thing that all of us here at The World are grateful for is you. This year has been another strange one. It hasn't been easy for anyone. For our newsroom, it's made it even clearer how important our work is. But what we don't always hear is how important the world is to you. In the last few weeks of our fall fundraiser, so many people have mentioned what the world brings to their lives, how they listen while making dinner or on their commute, and how the program connects them all to the world around us. Some found a new favorite musician thanks to our show, or were inspired to take their own deep dive into something we explored. It means so much to us, but we still need your help. Every week, our program reaches over 2 million listeners, but this year, only a small fraction have given to support the work. Right now, we need 388 people to answer the call and donate $130 or $11 monthly to support our nonprofit newsroom for another year. We need you. If you haven't donated yet, please add your name today to the already growing list of supporters. It only takes a minute. You can go to theworld.org/give to do it right now. And if you give $130 or pledge $11 monthly, I will personally thank you on this very podcast as a token of our gratitude. Please make your gift today at theworld.org/give. Now on to the show.
A new COVID variant sent the WHO into emergency session today and has countries around the globe banning flights and putting up travel restrictions. We have the latest on the COVID variant now known as Omicron. Plus, France and the UK are at odds over how to stop migrants from crossing the English Channel. The migrants are still pushing to get to Great Britain.
For many people, they get to France, they feel like the conditions here are just terrible.
I'm Carol Hills. Also this hour, we're looking back at our favorite business stories we've covered this year, from the comeback of vinyl records.
Streaming does generate money, but it does so over a long timeline. Vinyl generates money now.
To our feelings about supply chain problems.
I asked my friend if I'm just being a little whiny.
That's ahead today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Leaders at the World Health Organization emerged from an emergency meeting today with an announcement about a new variant of COVID-19.
Based upon the information that we have, particularly from South Africa, they have advised WHO that this variant should be classified as a variant of concern. So today we are announcing B11529 as a variant of concern named Omicron.
That's the WHO's Maria van Kerkhoff in Geneva today, explaining that the new variant is serious enough that they've named it Omicron, using the system of Greek names that helps scientists communicate with the public about the coronavirus. The U.S. and countries across Europe are already limiting who can travel from South Africa and neighboring countries where Omicron has been reported. We spoke earlier today with Stephen Buston, a professor of molecular medicine at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge.
Well, the first thing to remember is that there have been numerous variants already. What is different is that this variant seems to have so many different mutations all at once, or changes all at once. The second thing to remember is that so far, any variant we have seen, the vaccine has been effective against these variants. So at the moment, we just do not know whether this variant is going to be able to evade the vaccine protection that we have.
Do we know yet whether currently available vaccines for COVID will work against this new variant?
No, this is all too new. What is going to happen is that laboratory tests will be carried out where the virus is grown in a laboratory and then they use neutralizing antibodies to see if they attack the virus in the test tube. If you remember, when Delta appeared, everyone thought, well, the vaccine isn't going to work against Delta. But in fact, it did work, perhaps not quite as well as against the original variant, but it has worked, certainly against protecting us against severe disease. So my suspicion is that we will see something similar, that in the laboratory there will be some evidence that this virus can evade the protection afforded by the vaccination. In real life, my hope would be that it will not be as severe.
Now, the WHO has told countries not to take a knee-jerk reaction with travel bans. They want countries to use a data-driven approach instead. The UK, where you are, isn't following that advice. How do you think the UK government is handling this emerging situation?
So I think the WHO are wrong. I think it makes perfect sense to clamp down without knowing whether we are at risk or not, because it's going to be easier to open up if we're wrong and it turns out that this variant is not as transmissible or as or able to evade the immune system, then it would be to try and save a situation where the virus has become endemic in the United Kingdom. So I think it is the right approach now.
What about increasing vaccination rates around the world? Would that help keep this new variant from spreading?
Well, I think that is the essential element that is missing from a lot of our Western strategy. We are vaccinating our population. We are revaccinating, giving third shots, vaccinating children, and really forgetting that until the majority of the population in the world is vaccinated, we will always be at risk of something like this happening. So I think we should prioritize or certainly make an effort to spend a lot more money on bringing vaccines to developing countries and countries that can't afford to buy vaccines.
What is the best approach to this? People are really concerned. They're dealing with Delta, which changed the whole outlook about COVID and this pandemic.
Social distancing is certainly important because the virus transmits more easily if you are in close contact with somebody. A mask wearing, I know, in the United States is, you know, political. In the United Kingdom, it isn't. It's just here people have kind of given up and feel the pandemic is over. But mask wearing does protect against aerosols. And so, again, in a crowded situation, people should be wearing masks. So I think a combination of vaccination, being careful, not going out into crowded places if you can help it, wearing a mask if you can, personal hygiene, you know, washing your hands, not touching your face, all these things come together to help protect from any respiratory virus.
Stephen Buston is a professor of molecular medicine at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge in the UK. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The deaths of 27 people in the English Channel this week has Britain and France pointing fingers at each other. At issue is how to handle the problem of migrants making risky attempts to cross the Channel. This morning, French officials lashed out after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson published an open letter calling on France to take back migrants who reach British shores. Reporter Rebecca Rossman is in the French port city of Calais, where many migrants set off for the UK, and she joins me now. First, Rebecca, remind us about Wednesday's tragedy. What exactly happened?
We know that there were at least 27 victims, including a pregnant woman and three children. What happened was a fisherman saw about 15 bodies floating in the water in the English Channel just off the coast of Calais, and he immediately alerted rescue workers. Once they arrived on the scene, however, they saw that the inflatable boat that they were traveling in had completely deflated and that the majority of victims were already dead.
Oh, it's such a sad story. I mean, almost immediately after this, Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron got on the phone and talked. Explain what happened after that.
So in their initial talks, they were quite positive. There was some discussion about joint patrols between the UK and France, but things soured this morning. Last night, Boris Johnson sent French President Emmanuel Macron a letter where he said France and the UK should create some sort of bilateral agreement that would allow all illegal migrants who reach the UK via the English Channel to be sent back to France. That in itself angered the French government. A French government spokesperson lashed out this morning, calling the letter, quote, both poor in content and completely inappropriate in its form. But what really angered Macron is that Johnson decided to publish the entire letter on Twitter this morning, making it public. So the fallout from this has been quite drastic. France's interior minister this morning announced he was no longer inviting his British counterpart, Priti Patel, over for talks. They had been scheduled to hold emergency meetings here in Calais this Sunday to discuss the migrant situation, and that will no longer be happening.
Before today's diplomatic crisis, how were France and the UK cooperating on migrant crossings?
Both countries have long had this sort of uncomfortable relationship when it comes to dealing with migrants trying to cross the Channel. So for years, the UK has tried to, what they do is they send the French government money and they try and tell them to keep people in France and monitor the coastline. But there's several hundred kilometers of coastline and you can't keep everyone from crossing. More than 47,000 have tried to cross since the start of this year alone, and only a small fraction of these boats have been intercepted.
I was wondering about that because it seems like if migrants are trying to reach Europe, by the time they get to France, I mean, they're well inside the European Union. Why not stay there?
I think there's a certain amount of it that has to do with practical reasons, right? A lot of people probably already speak good English, or they have some English under their belt. Maybe they have family in the UK. A lot also say that it's easier for them to find work permits, or at least work under the table there. You know, often they get to France, they feel like the conditions here are just terrible. It's been raining here for days in Calais, and I was out this morning at a migrant camp, and it was just muddy. People were in tents in the pouring rain. There's reports of police using violent tactics against migrants, slashing their tents and whatnot. I did speak to one man from Iraq. He went by the name Talib. He wouldn't give me his first name. He said that he used to live in Germany, and he told me that he was considering going back there.
Because there the situation is better. Like, they're giving preliminary like support to the refugees, unlike here in France.
But he's also still not going to rule out the UK either, even if, given Wednesday's tragedy, he is reconsidering things a bit. You know, on a clear day, you can see the English coastline from here. So I think even with all the dangers, a lot of people feel like it's almost tangible for them.
Reporter Rebecca Rossman speaking to us from the port city of Calais in France about the crisis unfolding there. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We'll hear more from Rebecca later this hour on how France is leveling the playing field for booksellers. In Sweden this week, the Archbishop of the Church of Sweden issued an apology for historic wrongs committed against the Sami indigenous people. John Last reports on how the church is coming to terms with its checkered history.
In a service filled with singing and poetry in the endangered Sami languages, Archbishop Antje Jekelin stood before a congregation of indigenous delegates from across the Arctic. Describing one crime after another, she said again and again, "Today we acknowledge this. And on behalf of the Church of Sweden, I apologize. We pray to God," she said, "that we do not repeat past mistakes." Christianity came to Sápmi, the traditional territory of the Sami people, as long ago as the 11th century. But it was during the Reformation, when the church became an arm of the state, that its crimes against the Sami began. Helga West is a Sami theologian from Finland.
Churches were extensions of the state power. And this Lutheran mission was very harsh concerning the indigenous spiritualities.
West's research focuses on what she calls the spiritual destruction caused by the church. Traditional shamanism was outlawed and persecuted as witchcraft. Ancient yoiks, songs used by Sami shamans for thousands of years to connect with God in nature, were banned as demon worship. But the church also has more recent crimes to reckon with. During the ceremony, Rosemary Huva read a poem in the northern Sami language. "The priest and his servant dig up graves," it reads. "A race scientist requests the skull of a Sami infant." The poem is about priests that helped racist biologists dig up and desecrate Sami remains. Bishops in the church endorsed the idea that the Sami were an inferior race, and Sami languages were suppressed in church-run schools. But despite this legacy, most Sami are still Christians. Artist Thomas Colbengson is one of them. He says he struggles with these mixed identities, which are so deeply in conflict with one another.
There is this double feeling. So in a way, you got double guilt also. Guilt being Sami, guilt being Christian. So it's that's a sensitive thing to talk about.
Colbengson is somewhat skeptical of the reconciliation process just now getting underway. Some Sami worry it's easier for the church to apologize than for the government to take responsibility for its role. Sweden is still actively fighting Sami reindeer herders in court for the right to build energy and mining projects on their land.
Swedish government is doing nothing. They're barely even recognizing that there's a need for a reconciliation process.
Nila Marak is a Sami cultural advocate within the Church of Sweden. She and other advocates would like to see the church pressure the state to do better, like ratify an international convention on the rights of indigenous people. Even the church could take more concrete actions, returning stolen remains and handing over vast forests they control. But Mark says it's good to bring this history into the open.
A huge part of the reconciliation and the healing, of course, is that you actually admit that there has been damage done, you know, and that the Sami religion has been damaged and the Sami soul has been damaged.
She says an apology is a start, but forgiveness may take more time to come. For The World, I'm John Last in Uppsala, Sweden.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. This day after Thanksgiving is an opportunity to look at the money side of the holidays. And for the rest of the hour, we're bringing you some of our favorite stories about global consumer trends, pocketbook issues, and small businesses making a go of it. So if books are the kind of holiday gift you like to give, then take heart in our next story. France is trying to even the playing field between independent bookstores and Amazon. In addition to low prices, Amazon's free shipping is something that brick-and-mortar stores have had to compete with. A new French law on delivery fees is about to change that, as Rebecca Rossman first reported for us this fall.
Even before the age of Amazon and other e-commerce giants, France had a track record for protecting its independent booksellers. In 1981, the Lang Law, named for then-culture minister Jacques Lang, mandated that books be sold at the same price regardless of the store. In 2014, another law forbade online booksellers from giving discounts or free delivery. In response, Amazon set its minimum delivery fees at a single cent.
En préambule, je rappellerai que la dernière loi consacrée aux livres date de 2014.
But now the French government has shut down that loophole too.
Beaucoup de librairies indépendantes peinent à atteindre l'équilibre et sont menacées de disparition.
Speaking on the Senate floor in June, Senator Laure Darcos exclaimed that, quote, independent bookstores across France are struggling to keep up with Amazon. And the company's ability to charge just 1 cent in delivery fees means it is crushing all other competition. Her solution? Set delivery fees at a fixed price, too. Earlier this month, the Senate passed Darcos' bill, which will become law early next year. Anne-Laure Vial worked for Amazon before opening Ici Librairie in 2018, one of the largest independent bookshops in Paris. She says this new law is a, quote, game changer for her sprawling 5,000 square foot space.
So we're competing with the same price.
While the price of the new delivery fee hasn't been set yet, Vial says she typically has to charge anywhere from 7 to 9 euros per order. She also expects the forthcoming law to drive more traffic into her bookshop.
People will make the decision differently between choosing Amazon or choosing a physical bookstore, because this will be less expensive to go to the physical bookstore.
This latest tussle may be a symptom of a larger problem for Amazon's future in France. While the company's global sales skyrocketed in the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, its share of the French market actually went down by 3% in 2020. In a statement, an Amazon spokesperson told me that introducing a minimum shipping fee, quote, threatens customers' equal access to books, especially lower-income readers living in small towns and rural areas. But bookshop owner Anne-Laure Vial says Amazon is the one responsible for driving local bookshops out of these communities. She hopes this new law will help bring them back.
This will have a positive benefit on independent bookstores starting in rural areas in the future.
Vial says without these bookshops, readers won't discover books and authors that go beyond the bestseller categories.
Independent bookstores are the place where you can discover new books, new authors. So it's a place where you can discover creativity.
And she's proud of the French government for recognizing that. For The World, Rebecca Rossman.
In Spain, consumer prices rose faster last month than they have in 29 years. Rising energy costs are to blame, and they're causing another knock-on effect. More Spanish consumers are turning to renewable energy. Lucia Benavides reports from Barcelona.
Barcelona resident Josephine Ekned is waiting until 2 p.m. to get her dishwasher going today. The price of electricity drops for a few hours in the late afternoon when demand is low. Ekner's electricity bills doubled a few months ago. So now, she says she's reorganized her household chores to only consume energy when it's cheapest. Ekner and her husband don't have central air. But they use electric heaters when it's cold, so she's worried about prices going up even more. She says they're paying around $120 a month for electricity now.
Tiene más sentido como cambiar a energía renovable.
Ekner says she's making a change. She joined a renewable energy co-op. That means her electricity now comes from renewable sources. She says this makes the most sense not only economically, but for the future of our planet as well. Dirk Buschle is with an organization in Vienna called Energy Community. He says renewable energies are, in fact, cheaper and will continue to be in the long run. That's becoming clear right now with the historically high energy prices, which are affecting not just Spain, but all of Europe.
I think we are witnessing right now a situation where we see several factors coming together and producing an effect which in this way was probably not expected.
For starters, he says, there's the weather. It was not super windy this past summer, so wind turbines didn't produce enough power. That meant bringing back old sources of energy like gas and coal. At the same time, the international price of natural gas is shooting up, and because of a European emissions trading scheme to discourage the use of fossil fuels, so is the cost of CO2 emissions. In short, Dirk Buschle says the price for gas and coal is going up, but there are still not enough sources of renewable energy to make up for that.
We are in a transition from fossil fuels to renewable fuels in the energy sector. In the European Union, that goes by the name of Green Deal. I think we would have all be in a different situation right now and probably not suffered from these high prices if the transition had moved much, much faster.
The most expensive part of the transition, Buschle says, is creating a reliable grid for when renewable energies fail, that is, when there isn't enough sun or wind power. But that costs money. In Spain, the socialist government is putting new regulations in place to deal with skyrocketing energy prices. There's a cap on the price of natural gas, and it's lowered some taxes on electricity bills. But that's not all the government's doing.
Tenemos que apostar sobre todo por aquellas fuentes de energía más baratas.
Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez says the nation needs to bet on the cheapest energy sources, and that means renewables. José María Yusta is a professor at the University of Zaragoza. He specializes in energy markets. He says Spain has been moving faster than other European countries in transitioning to renewable energies.
Se están poniendo en marcha en el último año 700 megavatios.
In the last year, Yusta says hundreds of solar panels have been installed on residential buildings and warehouses, equaling up to 700 megawatts. He says the recent electricity price hike might push governments to act faster, and maybe influence consumers to switch to renewable energy by installing their own solar panels or joining energy co-ops.
Es decir, ya no es una cuestión solamente de política o de conciencia social, es también una cuestión de economía.
It's no longer a political or socially conscious issue, says Yusta, but an economic one. In the end, he adds, money may be the defining factor for boosting the renewable energy sector. For the world, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
More business stories from the past year are just ahead. You're listening to The World. One of our favorite business stories of 2021 was a walk through Ghana's massive market for secondhand clothes.
Traders pay between $20 and $400 to get these bales of used clothing. And the traders often never know whether the content is trash or treasure.
And fans of bubble tea search for the best non-plastic drinking straw. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Global music is one of the personal passions of The World's Marco Werman. But music isn't just about the sound. It's often about the business. And one music business trend this year is vinyl records. Here's Marco.
Earlier this year, I received a special, unexpected birthday gift, a turntable, which gave me license to start crate digging again. I found an early pressing of a Nina Simone classic. My baby don't
shows. My baby don't care for clothes.
I tracked down an old Jorge Ben vinyl in Brazil. A new album arrives on my porch about once a week now. I'm slightly obsessed, and evidently I'm not the only one. A few years ago, vinyl sales topped CD sales, and the resurgence has only grown. During the first 6 months of this year, nearly 20 million vinyl albums were sold in the U.S. alone. That's more than double from last year. Overseas, same deal. Heading into the holiday season, major recording acts are releasing their music on vinyl again, like Elton John and ABBA. There's even going to be a reissue of Prince's Purple Rain on purple vinyl, of course. Can you tell I'm geeking out? On the serious side, all this interest in vinyl is putting a strain on the few remaining record factories that can press them, and also on the demand for the chemicals used to make the vinyl. Daniel Knowles is an international correspondent at The Economist.
PVC is the chemical, polyvinyl chloride, which is the vinyl in vinyl. And it's used for lots of things in construction and medical supplies and cars, but it's also used to make the records. That's just this latest problem. There just isn't very much for around, especially the kind of colored vinyl that people want to make their records with.
The cause for this PVC shortage? Believe it or not, a storm, Hurricane Ida. It hit the petroleum industry hard. Most offshore oil and gas production in the Gulf was knocked out for more than a week when rigs and onshore support facilities were damaged in the hurricane. This is about basic economics, high demand, limited supply. Some of the bigger named acts will get the lion's share of vinyl pressings, which is putting smaller, less mainstream bands waiting their turn. Here's Daniel Knowles again.
I spoke to a heavy metal band from London called Green Lung. First And they produced their new album the end of last year, last December. And they've been basically waiting since to get it pressed. They were planning on launching in September, and they still haven't kind of got the vinyl. They're expecting 5,000 copies to be pressed. So I spoke to their lead singer, Tom Templar, who says, you know, it's actually really important to their kind of business model.
We're a heavy metal band. So basically, we're one of those genres where people still see vinyl as the sort of god format.
And I'm going to tell you now, it's like, it is killing me how long I've been sitting on these songs and waiting for people to hear them. And I know it's been killing the fans too.
So another person I spoke to was Dirk van der Heuvel of Groove Records, which is a big distributor of dance records in Chicago. And he basically said part of the problem is that all the major labels are kind of now using up what capacity there is in the industry. So you have Taylor Swift's new record, Evermore, which massively sold, and reprints of Fleetwood Mac's Rumours. And he kind of thinks that they're basically hogging the presses.
But hang on, this is the year 2021. Aren't streaming services still the big ticket? The Economist Daniel Knowles again.
Streaming does generate money, but it does so over a long timeline. Vinyl generates money now. So if you take that away, it makes it very difficult for bands just to kind of keep going.
Without selling vinyl, there's no way we would have been able to go on and put the money up front to go and do a big European tour or fly over to the States. So a lot of the sort of future of the band is wrapped up in still in selling physical releases, at least in the scene that we're in, you know. Vinyl is the key.
Tom Templar of the heavy metal band Green Lung there. According to Daniel Knowles, with all of this, there's good news, bad news for the band.
The trouble is, you won't be able to get hold of it because it's already completely sold out. So you'll just have to hope that they can get a second pressing, and maybe it'll be a bit faster than the first one.
Daniel Knowles of The Economist, talking about the supply and demand for vinyl LPs. Thanks to our partners at the Intelligence Podcast from The Economist for sharing that with us.
Earlier this year, the Chinese government banned disposable plastic in restaurants. That included plastic drinking straws. A win for the environment, but an outrage for fans of bubble tea. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai reported on the consumer backlash.
When you're drinking bubble tea, one thing you really can't do without is a straw.
How else can you suck up those chewy balls of tapioca? Most restaurants and cafes in China were using conventional polypropylene straws before the ban, and they made the switch to paper straws en masse. But customers were having none of it. Xiao Cao is sitting with his girlfriend at this trendy tea shop in Shanghai, drinking his daily cup of bubble tea. Paper straws are no good, he says. If you use them for too long, they get all soggy. It affects the taste. Bubble tea chains quickly offered up another straw option, made from PLA, a plant-based bioplastic. But the complaints from bubble tea drinkers had already started a national conversation around straws. In this Chinese TikTok video, a woman compares different types, complaining about each one. Glass straws are out, she says. They could break in your mouth. Plus, they're not sharp enough to puncture the seal. Neither can metal. Rubber has a weird aftertaste, she says. In all, she tries 6 different straws. In the past decade, China's begun tackling its waste problem, banning waste imports from the U.S. and other Western countries, and in 2019, piloting waste sorting schemes to separate food waste from other waste. But landfills and incinerators are still overused. Jiang Miao is the founder of an NGO focused on waste reduction. She says the ban on disposable plastics has created a loophole. Now sales of PLA bioplastic are way up. Yes, PLA is technically compostable under certain conditions, she says. But most people can't tell it apart from conventional plastic, and they just end up in the trash together. The problem isn't solved. Recycling is lacking infrastructure, she says. The government should support the development of a formal recycling system, she says, to better handle the plastic waste. Manufacturers have a role to play, too. I visited a straw factory in Yiwu, a city near Shanghai, to see how the ban has impacted their business. On the factory floor, machines spew out colorful straws. They're collected and bundled into boxes by workers. But instead of the conventional plastic ones that used to be produced here, now they are mostly making paper and PLA straws instead. I talked with a worker, Yun Lei, while he mans 3 machines at once. Reams of red and white paper ribbons pass through the machine. They're dipped in glue and wrapped around a metal dowel like a candy cane, then are cut into straw-length pieces. Yun waits till the straws pile up, then packs them into boxes. He says he handles 300,000 straws a day. My tour guide at the factory is Lo Zhongping, who's known in these parts as the king of straws. Turns out, after the plastic straw ban, his business is doing better than ever. Lo was a member of the study group that recommended the government ban disposable plastic straws. There's always going to be a market for straws, he says, but we have to push for change. During the pandemic last year, Lo replaced his machines with new ones to make paper and PLA straws. He made another switch. He dropped his export business for the most part and focused on the China market instead. Production is now up, and because the cost of these new materials is higher than conventional plastic, he can charge more too. Lo leads me to the showroom, which is full of reusable straws made of metal, heavy-duty plastic, bamboo, wood, glass, even some made from wheat stems. It's not that plastic straws themselves are bad, Lo says, just the way we use them. Still, his research team is trying different materials to wean people off their disposable habits. This straw made from corn and pumpkin starch is colorful, he says. And edible too. They taste like raw pasta and last an hour in cold drinks, he says, as he chews on one. Best of all, after you finish your drink, you can boil them up into spaghetti. There's still one problem. These straws will melt in a cup of hot bubble tea. Environmentalist Jiang Miao says there are no easy solutions. There's more attention being paid to plastic waste, she says. But people are so used to the cheapness and convenience of plastic, it's going to be hard to change their habits. The Chinese government is pushing on. promising upcoming bans on plastic bags and one-use plastic in hotels in the next few years. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
The fast fashion trend makes clothing cheaper, but there's a downside. It's estimated that each year, $500 million in new clothes are hardly worn. Often the clothes are never worn. Garments with Western labels end up in places like Ghana in West Africa, overwhelming Ghana's infrastructure and creating environmental problems. Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reported earlier this year from Ghana's capital, Accra.
Kantamantu, situated in the central business district of Accra, is a veritable city within a city, arguably one of the largest second-hand clothing markets in the world. Over 30,000 people in closely packed wooden stalls, bursting at their seams with large bales of second-hand fashion. From underwear to shirts, trousers, shoes, and the list goes on. Traders call these used clothes asobroniweu, meaning dead white man's clothes. One trader, Edith Ephraim, explains.
We believe no one will give out their clothes if they are alive. These clothes we sell belong to the dead white man.
Competition for customers is quite fierce. Traders here adopt all manner of antics to attract buyers. They sing and even dance. Ephraim has been in the trade for 17 years.
The business is really good. It is the proceeds from this second-hand trade that I use in paying all my bills and taking care of my children.
Traders pay between $20 and $400 to get these bales of used clothing. They buy them from Ghanaian middlemen who receive the donations. And the traders often never know whether the content is trash or treasure. From a distance, I can see some traders saying a prayer before cutting their bales open. As I walk through the hot, congested market, I end up in a corner with tailors and seamstresses washing, ironing, and mending or altering. A few meters away, I meet 20-year-old Daniel Frimpong with tons of second-hand jeans and buckets of blue dye solution in front of him. He says the color washing enhances the look of the items, which attracts more buyers.
When we do it like this, they give us good price for the jeans trousers. The job is helping us, we the unemployed youth.
No matter one's profession, age and gender, almost everyone in Accra shops at Kantamantu. Today is Saturday, and so many of the country's youth, like Nanekia, have thronged the market to shop.
Well, I like buying my stuff at Kantamantu because you can basically get everything there. Like, you get everything.
But moving large bales around Kantamantu with its narrow alleys is a tedious task. Therefore, that job rests on the shoulders of hundreds of female head porters, locally known as Kayaye. These head porters often carry loads twice their body weight and make less than $5 a day. Safiatu Aliu is one of them.
Are you happy doing it? Does it profit you?
It is good. By the grace of God, it is going well.
Just nearby, I see heaps of partly burnt garbage dominated by stuff like jackets, underwear, brassiers, and t-shirts. The reality is that every week, over 15 million pieces of used clothing arrive in Ghana from mostly the United States. And then 40% of those clothes leave the Kantamantu market as waste. Liz Ricketts is an American sustainable fashion campaigner in Ghana.
This isn't just an environmental crisis, it's a financial crisis for everyone who works in Kantamantu. Because the clothing is so much and so low quality, people just simply can't get their money back out and basically are operating in a debt cycle.
On top of that, every now and then, Accra experiences life-threatening floods that are worsened by the clothing waste that clog major open drains. Public health experts say this also increases the risks of malaria and cholera. Solomon Noy is head of waste management within the Accra metropolis. He says clothing in landfills creates huge amounts of methane gas and can cause devastating fires. Noy says this has led to the shutdown of the country's biggest landfill, which has compounded Ghana's waste management problems. On a visit to some beaches in Accra, I see textile waste and old clothing trapped in the sand ashore. Among the visible brands on the labels are H&M, Calvin Klein, Zara, and Urban Outfitters.
So a huge chunk of textile waste is stockpiling at the ocean bed.
Noy says polluting the ocean hurts the over 2 million people in Ghana whose livelihoods depend on the fisheries sector.
Some time ago, we had deaths of some species of fish along the coastline. I can tell you, some percentage of our ocean aquatic life will go.
Every year, the fashion industry uses 93 billion cubic meters of water and is responsible for 10% of annual global carbon emissions, more than all international flights and maritime shipping combined, according to the United Nations Environment Programme. Liz Ricketts says industrialized countries need to take responsibility.
Countries in the global north need to pay ecological reparations to clean up the mess that has been made.
Solomon Noy has another solution.
If you ask me from where I sit, a ban on secondhand clothing is the way forward.
But for the thousands of traders at Kantamanto, any such move must come with an alternative source of livelihood, especially in a country where soaring unemployment could be debilitating. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
We cannot approach the end of an hour of business stories from the past year without mentioning this phrase, supply chain. The World's Jason Margolis reported this year on the global bottleneck in shipping and distribution to try to tackle this vexing question. Where's my stuff?
Last summer, the caster wheel on my outdoor ping pong table broke, so I ordered a new one. Pretty straightforward. I invited my friend John Mulliken over to come play and talk through what happened. He knows a lot about moving stuff around the world, getting things from here to there. He used to be the chief technology officer at Wayfair,
the biggest online furniture retailer in the world.
All right, so here we are in my backyard. We just played ping pong. You're an excellent ping pong player. That wheel took me 6 months to get.
6 months is a really long time.
Does that surprise you?
Not at all. Everything was taking forever.
So given your expertise, why are you not surprised by this?
Well, it's your fault. It's my fault. It's all of our fault. I mean, we didn't go anywhere for 15 months, and people substituted experiences for stuff. They just started buying stuff, and more stuff. And there's only so many factories in the world, and there's only so many boats and planes in the world.
To get a little more technical, my ping pong wheel didn't arrive from Asia because global supply chains are out of whack. Sometimes with devastating impacts, says Thomas Romer. He co-directs MIT's LGO program, or Leaders for Global Operations.
I hear from manufacturers of sophisticated goods, like ventilators, we were waiting for people that could deliver the right bolts. We're talking bolts. We're talking about something that is actually fairly easy to manufacture.
Academics like Romer study this phenomenon where sudden changes in demand can create big production challenges up and down the supply chain. With the pandemic, things got a bit crazy. Everybody wanted hand sanitizer, toilet paper, individual ketchup packets, and bicycles like yesterday. Factories and businesses simply couldn't keep up. Then add this in, modern businesses have gotten really good at running lean. Holding excess inventory is expensive. Warehousing costs add up. After World War II, Toyota pioneered what's called just-in-time delivery. Inventory is created as needed. Toyota's model, avoid waste, stay nimble, save money. Willie Shi at the Harvard Business School says his students know these lessons well.
I look at students in the school and they're all allergic to carrying inventory, right? Because it all can be turned into cash.
For decades, our global supply chain system has mostly worked really well. But for things to go smoothly, businesses need to accurately forecast demand and have a reliable delivery system. Throw a big wrench in the system like a deadly global virus.
All those assumptions about easy movement of goods, reliability, dependability, low cost, those have all gone out the window. If you look at ocean container shipping, reliability and schedule reliability is at an all-time low.
So it's fairly simple economics, actually.
Mirto Kalopsidi is an economist specializing in trade and transport markets on the other side of Harvard's campus. She says it's about supply and demand with ships, too. Factories in Asia haven't been able to get access to sea transport. Then at U.S. ports, container ships have been backed up. That's partly because fewer dock workers were available during the pandemic.
So you're going to have a lot of people looking for ships. Prices are going to spike and there won't be enough ships to transport this.
Still, economists and business leaders say you don't blow up the system because of one wild year. So getting back to my ping pong wheel, let's put things in a bit of perspective. Is it really that big of a deal if my wheel was delayed by a few months? I asked my friend John Mulliken if I'm just being a little whiny.
Well, for a ping pong table, yeah, I mean, I think you are kind of whiny. You could have used a book. But for many pieces, like, you know, vital equipment to make equipment in hospitals do what they're supposed to do, they had the exact same problems. And that's not just being whiny. I mean, the reality is that we're used to behaving in a certain way. The whole economy has been spending decades trying to get leaner and leaner. And so that's all fine as long as everything goes exactly as predicted. And the reality is once there's a hiccup in the system, you're stuck.
So in answer to the question, where's my stuff? It's coming, but expect further delays. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Game to 11?
Sure.
You don't want to have any disadvantages? You don't have any excuses?
Beloved local pub bulldozed to make way for luxury apartments. That may sound like a familiar headline in your city, but for one pub in London called the Carlton Tavern, the story took an unexpected twist. After the Carlton was torn down in 2015, yes, for luxury apartments, members of the community successfully fought to make the developers rebuild the pub brick by brick. Now, an exact copy of the Carlton stands in its old spot. I spoke to Ben Martin, one of the new owners, back in March, and he told me how it felt to see the pub rebuilt.
It feels fantastic. I mean, I think a lot of the time when these developers buy these plots of land, they don't realise the historic value. These pubs have stood here for over 100 years, so people understand the level of community and the strength behind that.
So tell us a little bit about the history of the Carlton. I understand it even survived the Blitz.
It was originally built in about 1910, 1905, and it got bombed in the First World War, and then it was rebuilt again in 1921. And then it survived the Blitz in the Second World War, one of the only buildings on the whole of the road that survived it. It stood the test of time over all that time, you know, and then to be knocked down within an hour was kind of obviously very tragic to the local community.
How did the community get this to happen, to get the developer to rebuild the pub?
It started off with Heritage, as in British Heritage, were coming here to potentially make it a Grade 2 listed building because of the historical value to the community. And I believe the developers kind of knew that was on the cards, that was going to happen. So this is when they decided to bulldoze it. And it meant a lot to the people. You know, the people used to come here, they'd use it. It was part of their life. And I think when that was just taken away, they were like shocked and devastated. And they wanted to do something about it. So I guess with the clout of British Heritage behind them, the local community got together and they rallied and they said, this can't happen. We need to take this to the courts and we need to talk to Westminster Council and see if we can get them to rebuild it.
When I first heard about this story, I thought that the developers tore down the Carlton pub and that everybody pushed back. So they had to rebuild the Carlton pub like next to the new condos. But you all got the developers to just rebuild it and they never really got their condos, did they?
No, they didn't. They have had to rebuild the pub. You know, so all the detail that's back in the building is absolutely fantastic. You walk in the building, you wouldn't think it was built in the last 2 years. It's stunning. Like, you know, we are incredibly excited to have such a beautiful building, to be able to create a great community pub again. And there's also a notice on it from Westminster Council to say that it will never be anything other than a pub, so it can never be knocked down ever again.
Ben Martin is one of the new owners of the Carlton Tavern, a London pub that was rebuilt brick by brick by the developers who demolished it. Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Lovely to speak to you.
Since we spoke, the Carlton reopened for business. They're also available to book your Christmas party. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Enjoy your holiday weekend.
A brief note before we go, we're able to bring human-centered stories from across the globe straight to your ears every day because listeners like you support the work. The world is free for everyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. Donate today to support our nonprofit newsroom. With a gift of $130 or $11 monthly, you'll get a shout-out from me on this podcast. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to donate. Thank you from all of us here at The World.
From PRX.